The headlines: Iran holds a funeral ceremony for its ambassador to Yemen who passed away on Tuesday due to complications from COVID-19. Near constant Saudi bombardments halt aid flights into Yemen, already suffering under years of blockade. And France announces a record surge in COVID cases, linking an estimated 20% to the Omicron variant. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Iranians bid farewell to the country's ambassador to Yemen, Hassan Irloo, who passed away on Tuesday. The funeral is held in the capital, Tehran, with people from all walks of life taking part in the event. The Iranian diplomat was transferred to Iran for COVID-19 treatment. However, a delay in his flight from Sana'a compounded his illness. The foreign ministry held another funeral for the late ambassador on Tuesday.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry held a funeral ceremony for Hassan Irloo, Iran's ambassador to Yemen, who passed away due to acute COVID-19 on Tuesday morning, local time. The Iranian diplomat had tested positive for the coronavirus in Yemen. On Sunday, he was transferred to Iran for treatment using an Iraqi airliner. But a delay in his flight from Sana'a compounded his illness. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian held Saudi Arabia accountable for the passing away of the Iranian envoy, saying Riyadh impeded efforts for timely evacuation of the diplomat from Yemen.
We had for days been trying to obtain a permit through a third country to send a plane from Iran or another country to quickly transport Hassan Irloo to a well-equipped hospital in Iran. But unfortunately, the Saudi side made a very late decision in this regard, and some of the executive apparatuses in Saudi Arabia drag their feet. We will officially register our protest based on international conventions.
Irloo officially began his diplomatic mission to Yemen's National Salvation Government in December 2020. A month later, the United States added him to the list of its sanctions in protest of Iran's ties with Yemen's Ansarullah movement. Ansarullah has been defending Yemen against the Saudi-led coalition's aggression, which enjoys full logistic support from the U.S. and U.K. Saudi Arabia and its allies invaded Yemen in 2015 with the aim of restoring power to Riyadh's favorite government. Some 7 years on, the invasion has claimed the lives of tens of thousands of Yemenis and brought Yemen close to the brink of outright famine.
During his short tenure as Iran's ambassador to Yemen, the Iranian diplomat made major efforts to facilitate Iran's humanitarian and medical aid to the war-torn country. So it's going to be missed by Yemenis who have been living under years of Saudi-imposed blockade that denies them access to relief supplies. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Saudi-led military coalition steps up its aggression against Yemen, carrying out dozens of fresh airstrikes on various parts of the country. During our News Review program, we discuss the matter with our guests.
And welcome everyone to News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Saudi Arabia stepped up attacks on Yemen with warplanes carrying out dozens of fresh air raids on the impoverished nation. No casualties have been reported so far. Earlier, an anonymous Yemeni airport official said UN aid flights have been halted due to multiple airstrikes by Saudi warplanes. Also on Monday, a Saudi-led coalition carried out dozens of airstrikes across several provinces. The Saudi blockade of Yemen has hampered ordinary flights at Sana'a Airport, but aid cargo are usually allowed to bring in much-needed supplies there. UN says hundreds of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have been killed since Riyadh, along with its allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen in early 2015. Joining us now for the program is Mr. Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War from Hamilton, Ontario, and Hamza Shaiban, Yemeni activist and political commentator, joining us from Toronto, Canada. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we're starting with you, Mr. Ken Stone. Your initial thoughts on the story, please.
My initial thoughts are that the lesson to be drawn from the Saudi attack, illegal attack and targeting of civilian infrastructure at Sana'a's international airport by the Saudi coalition is further proof, conclusive proof, that the U.S., the word of the U.S. cannot be trusted. I think your viewers will recall back in February when President Biden made an announcement that he was changing course on the Saudi war on Yemen, and he was no longer going to support the so-called offensive war on Yemen. Instead, in the last few months, he has authorized the sale of $650 million worth of arms to Saudi Arabia, and he has, you know, given the continuing green light for the Saudi coalition to bomb Yemen, the poorest country in the Arab world, and to continue to make it difficult for humanitarian aid to get to the people who are starving to death in Yemen because of the blockade that the Saudi coalition, which is, as your announcer said, completely backed logistically by the U.S. and U.K., preventing the people of Yemen to get enough food to survive, that's predicted that 377,000 Yemenis will have died by the end of this year. It's a crime against humanity, and it shouldn't be allowed to continue.
Thank you, Ken. And Hamza, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Mr. Hamza Shaiban joining us from Toronto. Hope you're safe and doing well out there. Why is it, to Ken's point, that it seems that the Saudis are going more after targets that affect Yemen's civilian population more so than they are going after Houthi Ansarullah or Yemeni army targets?
Yeah, definitely. This just shows that Saudi Arabia have used all their cards in this war to, and they literally have no other options but to put more pressure on the Yemeni people. The airport, the Sana'a airport, for over 5 years have been used only for 8 flights and UN delegations to come to Yemen. So, if you think about it, Saudi Arabia have no other cards to use in this war. They're losing in the battlefield in Marib and Shabwa and many other front lines. The only card they have right now is Sana'a Airport, which is mostly targeted at affecting the people of Yemen and not Ansarullah. What makes me think about this it's a crime, because again, the international laws are being violated by Saudi Arabia, backed by U.S. and Western governments. Yet we don't see any solid reactions from these governments or the UN and the international community.
And Hamza, last thoughts with you. We have about a minute left. The U.S. along with their allies, Canada, that our friend from Hamilton, Mr. Ken Stone, alluded to. They continue to help the Saudis, and they're also at the same time the self-proclaimed champions of human rights. So when the humans in Yemen need their rights, need their protection, need security, where are their champions in the West?
I think the people in Yemen today, they know exactly that whatever the U.S. administrations have been saying for the past 7 years, or the Canadian government, the way they've been dealing with the war in Yemen by supplying arms to Saudi Arabia, they know exactly that these countries could not be claiming that they want peace for Yemen or Yemeni people. They understand this very well, and they see these Western governments as part of this war, and they're part of the Saudi coalition, and they're fueling the war per the UN report that your host mentioned.
Thank you, gentlemen. Stay safe, both of you. Thanks. It was a pleasure to have you both on. Mr. Kent Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War from Hamilton, Ontario, and Hamza Shaiban, a Yemeni activist and political commentator, also joining us from Canada, the city of Toronto, to be exact. And viewers, that's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. The notorious Israeli-made spyware Pegasus is making headlines again. New revelations are suggesting a link between the malware and slain dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi's inner circle. Here are the details.
Over the past months, numerous reports have suggested that a powerful spyware, dubbed Pegasus, has been used by authoritarian governments around the world against journalists, human rights activists, and opposition leaders. The malware activates the infected phone's cameras and microphones and collects its location data, call logs, and contact entries. NSO, the Israeli company developing the malware, sales it has sold Pegasus to over 60 government agencies in 40 countries under licenses granted by Israel's Ministry of Military Affairs. One of the most notorious of all has been the United Arab Emirates, which has used Pegasus to spy on activists, journalists, and even the former wife of the ruler of Dubai. A cybersecurity analyst at the University of Toronto says he's found traces of the malware on the cell phone of Jamal Khashoggi's wife, Hanan Alatr. On April 21, 2018, Alatr was arrested at the Dubai airport by security agents who interrogated her about Khashoggi and confiscated her two Android phones. They reportedly entered a link on one of the phones that sent over the military-grade spyware package to the device. The incident took place about 5 months before the journalist was killed and dismembered at Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul. According to human rights groups, the UAE, a close ally of Saudi Arabia, has conducted espionage operations on Saudi dissident activists abroad on the behalf of Riyadh. The revelation is the first that links Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Israel in an apparent joint intelligence venture. Although a U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman directly ordered the assassination, no measure was taken against him. Tel Aviv and Abu Dhabi are likely to evade accountability for their possible roles all the same.
Political commentator Ali Al-Ahmed says it's unlikely that those involved in the assassination of Khashoggi are brought to justice.
Yeah, the Emiratis own Washington at the moment, and as you can see very clearly, in a year time, the Biden administration has changed its narrative on Saudi Arabia from, oh, we are not going to deal with MBS, to increasing their support, especially their military support and international support with the visit of French President Macron to Riyadh, and the increasing American support for the Saudi military, especially in the air. The Saudi Air Force and the American Air Force are training together. During the same time, the Saudis are flying daily, dozens of daily bombing raids on Yemen, killing dozens of civilians, and the Americans are not saying anything about it because they are supporting this campaign.
Elsewhere, the United States renews its threats against Iran, saying other options are available in case talks on reviving the 2015 deal fail. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says little time remains for the negotiations in the Austrian capital. Similarly, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran says only a few weeks remain for saving the deal, also known as the JCPOA. According to Rob Malley, there will be a period of escalating crisis if the U.S. concludes that the agreement is no longer valid. Iran has held several rounds of negotiations with the remaining JCPOA parties in recent months. The deal was thrown into chaos after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the accord and reimposed sanctions on Iran back in 2018. Tehran is demanding a verifiable removal of all sanctions and guarantees that Washington won't repeat the past. The Israeli military shoots dead a Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. The victim has been identified as 22-year-old Abdel Aziz Hikmat Musa. The Israeli military claims he tried to ram his car into a number of regime soldiers. This comes shortly after the military announced a decision to change its open fire rules in the occupied West Bank. The new regulations allow Israeli soldiers to shoot at Palestinians who throw stones even if they don't pose an imminent threat. Israel has long been criticized for using excessive and deadly force against Palestinians. The co-president of the Palestinian and Jewish Unity, Bruce Katz, says unprovoked killing of Palestinians is a common practice in the Israeli army.
This is simply rendering official what the Israeli army has been doing de facto for many years now. That is simply shooting Palestinians without any real provocation. What this particular military tactic or policy, which by the way goes against all aspects of international law and rules of conflict, what it does permits Israeli soldiers to shoot and kill Palestinians who are actually fleeing and do not present a threat to Israeli troops.
The Omicron variant of the coronavirus is taking over Europe at high speed. The World Health Organization is warning European nations to brace for a significant surge in COVID cases as the highly transmissible variant spreads across the continent. The WHO's European head says the strain has found its way to at least 38 out of 53 countries in the region. Hans Kluge says the variant is already dominant in Denmark, Portugal, and the UK, adding that it will take over more European countries within weeks. Kluge has also warned that a high number of new infections will cause widespread disruption to health systems and other critical services. On Tuesday, Britain reported over 90,000 new cases and 172 more deaths. France has also announced a record surge in its cases. Germany has reported over 23,000 new cases and 462 more deaths. The government has announced contact restrictions, including for vaccinated and recovered individuals starting from December 28th. Under the new rules, private gatherings of more than 10 vaccinated people will no longer be allowed, even on New Year's Eve. Russia also says nearly 26,000 people have tested positive for the coronavirus in the past 24 hours. This includes 41 Omicron cases. It has imposed restrictions on travelers coming from South Africa, where the Omicron variant was first detected. On November 24th, the strain has spread to nearly 90 countries. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
At the end of the day, the U.S.-Israel alliance is a lot stronger than any notion of democracy or human rights, says Jessica Boxbaum, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Biden administration's reluctance to spend geopolitical capital greenlights Israeli settlement push. Stay tuned for more. Recently, the Zionist regime bowed to American pressure and scrapped the controversial Atarot settlements in the Palestinian neighborhood of Al-Andia, just north of Al-Quds. But on the heels of that decision, the regime advanced another Jewish settlement in Palestinian neighborhoods along Al-Quds' southern tip, even as the residents there are grappling with a severe housing shortage. The plan is to develop a new neighborhood called Givat HaShaked on land expanding beyond the Green Line, the Zionist regime's de facto border before the 1967 war, which saw it occupy its Al-Quds, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip, and adjacent to the Palestinian neighborhood of Beit Safafa in occupied East Al-Quds. Recently, the Al-Quds Municipality Planning and Building Committee recommended the development plan for the passage, meaning it will now head to Al-Quds District Planning Committee, which will decide whether to deposit the plan for objections or public review. The project calls for construction of 473 homes, schools, and synagogues to be built on about 9 acres of open land. During the committee hearing, the Zionist regime's custodian general, the authority within the Justice Ministry overseeing properties whose owners are unknown, was represented by its economic unit director, Hanel Gorfinkel. Gorfinkel is a right-wing activist known for supporting Jewish settlements in East Al-Quds. Givat HaShaked is not the only settlement in East Al-Quds being pushed by the custodian general. Documentation obtained by Haaretz reveals Givat HaShaked is one of 6 Jewish neighborhoods the Zionist regime is currently advancing across East Al-Quds. These include one in Sheikh Jarrah, one near Damascus Gate, one in Sor Bahar, one in Beit Haniya, and another in Beit Safafa. Activists emphasize that Gorin Fekel's appointment is directly intertwined with the heightened settlement activity and the displacement of Palestinians in East Al-Quds. Amy Cohen, Director of International Relations and Advocacy at Al-Quds focused Israeli human rights organization Er Amim, said of Gorfinkel, "What we have seen is that since his appointment in 2017, there has been a substantial increase in eviction lawsuits against Palestinians and the expansion of Jewish settlements in Palestinian areas." According to Er Amim, the acreage set for Givat HaShaked is actually on land that is undergoing formal land registration in the Sharafat area of Beit Safafa. The Zionist regime's 2018 decision 3790 was marketed to the public as a means to push economic development in East Al-Quds and reduce socioeconomic inequality. The initiative reserved 50 million shekels, nearly $16 million for the registration of land rights in East Al-Quds, an important prerequisite needed to secure building permits. The Zionist regime authorities often use the absence of building permits as justification for demolishing Palestinian homes. However, as uncovered by Er Amim, land registration procedures are being used to advance Jewish settlements as found in Sheikh Jarrah, rather than develop Palestinian neighborhoods in Al-Quds. On one hand, Decision 3790 is depicted as a tool to aid Palestinians, Cohen told Min Press News, adding, and yet it's being used to further the expansion of Jewish settlement and confiscation of Palestinian land and property. Land registration is supposed to be a transparent and publicized process, Sari Kronish, East Al-Quds planner at Israeli Regime Planning Rights Organization, BIMCOM, explained. The regime is supposed to publish a map of areas of the plots and invite people to make claims. And if claims are made that contradict each other, then the registrar is supposed to send those claims to court to be clarified, Kurish said, adding, but the way the regime is actually doing it, we see that it's being done quietly. People often don't know that's happening. We don't know yet of a single case where the Palestinians will be able to benefit from it, Kronish added. Area reserved for Givat Hashaket was once sought after for development by former Zionist regime Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. In 1995, Rabin put forward a housing project for the land, sparking international outcry. The UN Security Council voted to have the Zionist regime halt the plan, with the United States vetoing the resolution. Rabin shelved his expropriation days after the UN vote in what has been speculated to be an exchange for the US veto. Now the current Zionist regime is going beyond what any previous leadership dared to. Daniel Scheidman, founder and director of Israeli nonprofit Terrestrial Al-Quds, emphasized. These settlement plans are now on the agenda, Scheidman told Min Press News, adding, relations between the United States and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett are charged at the moment. Scheidman continued, the Americans have made their concerns very clear about the settlement of E1 and Atarot. So why is Bennett having another poke in the eye over something like this? Lara Friedman, president of the American Nonprofit Foundation for Middle East Peace, FMEP, agreed the new government is stepping into territory even Bennett's predecessor wouldn't touch. They are as bad as the Benjamin Netanyahu cabinet, and in many ways, they are worse, Friedman said, adding, these settlements are absolutely incompatible with any commitment to anything other than permanent Israeli control over the entire area, Friedman added, highlighting the record number of home demolitions throughout Area C of the occupied West Bank as another way Bennett's cabinet is pushing increased annexation. From Er Amim's Cohen's perspective, despite Bennett's cabinet being a politically diverse coalition, hardline voices are the ones in power. Far-right members of the coalition are put in very strategic high-level positions like in the Ministry of Interior, Ministry of Housing, Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Justice, Cohen said. All of these portfolios are very senior and they have a lot of weight. And what we have seen is because of this, they're quietly able to advance this very far-right-wing agenda. Prominent right-wing politicians hold top spots in Israel's cabinet. Ayelet Shaked is Interior Minister. Zeev Elkin is the Minister of Housing and Construction. And Gideon Saar serves as the Minister of so-called Justice. Settlement expansion becomes the defining feature of Bennett's regime. The other side of the Atlantic is becoming increasingly more vocal about the Zionist occupation and land theft. In November 26, U.S. House Democrats penned a letter urging Secretary of State Antony Blinken to stop the Zionist regime from moving forward with a settlement plan in E1 area of the West Bank. The move was led by Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan, who recently toured a Palestinian village in the West Bank with New York Representative Jamal Bowman. And Minnesota Representative Betty McCollum has become a strong advocate for for Palestinian rights in Congress. The Democrat has sponsored two bills related to U.S. military aid to the Zionist regime and said the state practices apartheid. On the Givat HaShaket proposal, an ongoing settlement expansion in Palestine, McCollum told Min Press in a statement, the Zionist regime's state-sponsored expansion of settlements on Palestinian land, while the Israeli cabinet bureaucrats deny Palestinian permits to even build homes and bulldoze existing Palestinian homes, schools, and businesses, is destroying the prospect of a Palestinian state and the prospects for peace. The global community views the Israeli settlement expansion as illegal and lethal to any future peace process, and the U.S. government should not be silent. The situation has reached a point in which the Palestinians are clearly a people denied even basic human rights while under Israeli regime subjugation. U.S. lawmakers are emerging as more and more critical of Israeli regime, but that hasn't stopped the Israeli regime violence. In fact, the Zionist regime appears almost fueled by the condemnation. But at the end of the day, the U.S.-Israel alliance is a lot stronger than any notion of democracy or human rights. No U.S. administration wants to be perceived as picking 10 fights every day with Israel, even if Israel is engaging every day in 10 things that really demand a response from the U.S.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Russian president has warned that Russia is prepared to take military technical measures in response to unfriendly Western actions over Ukraine. Now, Western governments accuse Moscow of planning to invade Ukraine, citing Russia's military buildup near the border. The Kremlin has rejected the claim and demands legal guarantees over its security from the U.S. and NATO. Now, Putin says his country would be forced into a tough response unless the West dropped its aggressive line. In tonight's Spotlight, we'll discuss the growing tensions between Russia and the U.S.-led NATO and their fallout for the world.
In recent weeks, tensions between Russia on one side and Ukraine and the U.S.-led NATO on the other have reached an alarming new level, raising fears of an armed conflict. The two sides have time and time again accused each other of provoking a military escalation in Ukraine and warned of serious consequences. In the latest development, the Russian president has blamed the West for escalating tensions in Europe, citing NATO's eastward expansion and the U.S. withdrawal from missile treaties like the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty and the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. Vladimir Putin says Washington's judgment has been clouded by euphoria after what he regarded as his victory in the Cold War. The Russian leader has also warned that his country is prepared to take military technical measures in response to unfriendly Western actions over Ukraine.
Russia stands for equal and indivisible security throughout the Eurasian area. Of course, as I have already noted, if our Western colleagues continue their aggressive course of action, we will take adequate military and technical actions in response. We will react toughly to unfriendly steps. And I want to emphasize, we have every right to do so. We have every right to take actions aimed at ensuring the security and sovereignty of Russia.
The warning comes as the US and its European allies have stepped up their anti-Russia rhetoric under the pretext that Moscow is building up its troops to invade Ukraine. They have also warned Russia of consequences despite its repeated denial of any incursion plan. Russia argues that it's the US and NATO that are infringing upon it with an eastward expansion and by arming Ukraine under false excuses. Russia has also demanded legal security guarantees regarding the situation around Ukraine. In the draft security pacts published on Friday, Russia urged NATO to give up any military activity in Eastern Europe and Ukraine and roll back the deployment of its troops and weapons. The documents also call for a ban on sending both US and Russian warships and aircrafts to areas from where they can attack each other's territory. In addition, the documents demand a halt to NATO's military drills near Russia's borders. However, many experts have cast doubt on the possibility of reaching an agreement between the US and Russia, saying even if Washington accepts such terms, there is still no guarantee that it remains committed to them.
If we look at it contemporarily, US promises and guarantees and even signed treaties and negotiations mean nothing. I mean, Iran knows this with the JCPOA, the different nuclear treaties which have been violated by the United States unilaterally. So these are worthless, and I doubt that they will actually make any agreement.
The United States, especially under the presidency of Joe Biden, has made its best efforts to provide military support to Ukraine, which lies on Russia's doorstep. In September, Washington signed a new cooperation agreement in the field of defense and security with Kiev. In the meantime, the U.S. is training military personnel in the Eastern European country, upgrading the country's ports to fit its warships and supplying it annually with hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid. The Biden administration's policies show that Washington is trying to keep tensions escalating to reduce Russia's influence in Eastern Europe, and Ukraine seems to be the best place to aim this goal. Russia, on the other hand, argues that while Ukraine is free to decide the security arrangements, those cannot threaten Russia's interests and security, insisting that Ukraine joining the NATO military alliance would cross a red line. As tensions between Russia and NATO over Ukraine are escalating, there are serious concerns about the potential for military escalation, potentially to the point of full-blown war.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who is joining us in this episode. Independent analyst Tim Kirby is in Moscow. Also, journalist and political commentator Jim Kavanaugh is joining us out of New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now, let me turn to Tim. Russian President Vladimir Putin said just a few hours ago that what the U.S., I'm quoting him, what the U.S. is doing in Ukraine is at our doorstep, and they should understand that we have nowhere further to retreat to. So, Tim, what do you make of Putin's sentence when he says that Russia has no other place to retreat to?
That may be in reference to some of the silliness regarding the location of Russian troops within Russia. Because they keep receiving warnings from Washington that Russia needs to pull back its troops, pull them back. Well, to where? Russian territory. There's essentially Russia really, from within itself, also in a more abstract sense, feels that it really can't give up any more than it's already given up, especially during the break for Soviet Union. So that's essentially the logic.
Okay. And Jim, Putin also says that Western countries are arming and urging an extremist from a neighboring country at Russia. Do you think we'll just watch idly? That's his question. So will just Russia stand idly by and see what's happening along its borders?
You know, Putin has been saying this for years. There are videos that from 2016, 17, 18, where he's talking to Western press and he's saying, you are not reporting what's happening. This is very dangerous. Tensions are escalating. And this has been going on for years. And, you know, the United States promised not to move an inch closer to Russia, to move NATO an inch to the east after the breakup of the Soviet Union. They broke that promise. And, you know, Putin has been saying we cannot allow a military infrastructure, missiles that can reach our homeland in 5, 10 minutes to approach our borders. And now you have a situation in Ukraine where, you know, the accession of Ukraine to NATO has been saying for a long time is a red line. Even the planting of what he calls the infrastructure of NATO into Ukraine, which is actually happening. In other words, they're being integrated in everything but name only. There are American soldiers in Ukraine, and there are American mercenaries in Ukraine, and they're there to act as tripwires in case anything happens. And you have the division of Ukraine, which is really the nut problem here. You have fascist forces in Western Ukraine backing the Kiev government. They want to take the Donbas regions back, Donetsk and Lugansk. There's an agreement, a Minsk agreement, that was negotiated in 2015. They don't want to abide by it because that would require giving those regions some kind of political autonomy. So really, this whole brouhaha about Russia's going to invade Ukraine is really they're getting ready, I believe, to make an offensive against eastern Ukraine to take it back, and they don't want Russia to come in and prevent that, which Russia would do. And I think that probably would do. I can't speak Russian, but I think the buildup on the border is partly about that. It's saying to the West, don't try and, you know, use these because the Ukrainian army can't do anything by itself. It's going to need the help of NATO and the United States, and that's what Russia is saying. Stay out of this, you know. Do not. We don't want to see. Russia doesn't want to invade Ukraine and take over Ukraine. There's no reason for that. But they will not allow, I don't think, the Kiev regime to come back and attack the eastern Donbas region.
Okay. Now, Tim, Putin also has been warning the U.S. and NATO against stoking tensions near the Russian borders. But this was the first time that he explicitly talked about a potential military conflict and, in his words, appropriate retaliatory military technical measures. So what do you make of his tone this time and the fact that he was addressing Russian defense ministry officials?
Well, it's definitely a warning that he means business. We shouldn't forget that during the Maidan crisis in the Ukraine, which turned into a revolution, and the breakaway of the Crimea, that was really a flashpoint moment where when the Crimea left, it could have actually caused World War III. And we have to keep cool heads, and I think Putin just wanted to make a clear reminder that, like, look, if you try to betray us, if you try to make some sort of sneaky business, we're going to go in and we're going to do something. You know, basically saying that let's not play chicken, let's not play games, let's all get out of this alive and well.
Now, Jim, what Moscow wants, and it has actually outlined these as red lines, are, you know, a set of security guarantees from the West, including denying NATO membership for Ukraine, withdrawal of U.S. and NATO troops from Eastern Europe. So would the U.S. accept these or not? And because, you know, there are arguments that rejecting these demands would risk closing off any space for dialogue and further escalating the crisis.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, but these are the kinds of things that would have been standard procedure in the age of détente, you know, when the United States and Russia were actually making agreements with each other. And what's happened now is the political atmosphere in the United States is so toxic about this that it's very difficult for anybody to do that, for the president to do that. The Russophobia is rampant among Republicans and Democrats. And you have, you know, as Putin said, and as everybody knows, the United States abrogated and broke treaties. It replaced, essentially, since during the Yeltsin period, from essentially the Yugoslavia to Libya, the United States was able to do anything it wanted militarily in the world, and Russia would not stand in its way. That changed, starting with Ukraine and Syria. And now you have a situation where Russia is saying, let's have agreements where everybody backs off, where we agree to not station troops here, to not put this kind of military equipment here. These are reasonable things. But the United States has gotten used to having its way. And the political atmosphere in the United States now is really toxic in the sense that, you know, everybody wants, literally, the majority of Democrats are ready to go to war with Russia over Ukraine. And so, you know, it's going to be very hard for an American president to make agreements with Russia and not be characterized as being weak, being soft on Russia, giving things up, et cetera. So it's a very difficult political situation.
Mm-hmm. And Tim, how do you think Washington would have reacted if Moscow had done the same and deployed massive military equipment and troops on the U.S. doorsteps? And
well,
if you remember, the two countries,
the Cold
you know,
War was called the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Exactly.
Of course, they absolutely freaked out and went completely insane, which we can understand because having nuclear missiles that close to U.S. territory was terrifying. But at the same time, the nuclear missiles that NATO was able to get into Turkey during the Cold War that were relatively just as effective, that went rather silent. So I imagine that the situation would really resemble the Cuban Missile Crisis in terms of scale. However, we're in the 21st century, and that scale would include a lot more social media.
Okay. And Jim, do you also believe that what's happening at Russia's border is similar to the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis?
Yes, very much so. And those missiles in Turkey, there was an agreement made silently. The Americans didn't admit it explicitly, but Kennedy agreed and later took those missiles out of Turkey. But he wouldn't do it explicitly. He couldn't make that concession explicitly. But even more than that, I want to go back to the Bay of Pigs, because what you have there, this is the point. We have wild card actors here. We have these fascist forces in Ukraine that are pushing, and they're being given rhetorical and military support by the United States, and they may think, like the CIA did at the Bay of Pigs, well, if we go do that, we're going to force the president's hand. He's going to have to come support us. And they may think if we go attack Donbass, well, NATO is going to have to come support us. And that's why you have a very dangerous situation, because there are wild cards in this situation that can, you know, make things happen that nobody really wants to have happen.
Right. And Tim, what message was the U.S. sending when it simply quit the Open Skies Treaty and also the INF? You know, Russia's already warned that it might redeploy intermediate range nuclear missiles in Europe, and that in response to what it sees as NATO's expansion toward its borders.
Now, about these agreements, one thing we have to remember is that when we look at agreements between people, we tend to look at them from our own individualistic standpoint. But when you sort of look at them in a real politic, might makes right sort of dynamic, you can see that even if something is written on paper, the broken, impoverished former Soviet Union really wasn't in any position to enforce, especially during the Yeltsin period, any particular agreements that it would have had with Washington, even if Washington would have put a lot of things in writing that it didn't. So, and with some of the other treaties about missiles and how they've been violated, essentially it's really a matter of power dynamics because between forces that actually can exert power onto each other, you know, between two actors in foreign relations, you can have a treaty, you can have an agreement, especially if both sides are monitoring each other. You know, the islands of Fiji, could they really enforce a treaty on Washington? Of course not. They have no means to. And the Russia of the 90s and sort of early 2000s was unable to. But current Russia seems to be able to. It would seem that things are changing. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the most important dynamics for this entire new agreement process is the real big question is, does Washington see itself as still being this global hegemon in a monopolar world order where it's trying to make a continue a Pax Americana that doesn't have much Pax in it, right? Or has it, like some generals and other people have sort of admitted, starting to see itself in sort of a multipolar, at least tripolar world, and it might be willing to negotiate in that context? And that's really the most important factor, how Washington sees itself and its own future. That'll really determine how all this goes.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jim, you know that the West has said that we want dialogue with Russia, a meaningful one, in their words, and also on the basis of reciprocity. And that's what Moscow also had asked for, direct negotiations. So what do you think could come out of this?
Well, you know, these are nice principles that everybody enunciates, but as Tim was saying, you know, in not just the power dynamics militarily, but also the political dynamics are you know, very strong here. And there's going to be so much resistance to anything that can be characterized as a concession to Russia. The United States got used during that Yeltsin period from Yugoslavia to Libya of getting anything it wanted, of being a unipolar actor and of replacing essentially the international system based on the United Nations with its own notion of the international community, which was essentially itself and its allies. And they don't want to go back to that. And what's happening in with Russia and countries like China and Iran is that they have met, you know, they've built up enough strength, certainly in their own regions, to now be able to resist American absolute hegemony. And the Americans have to decide, American elite has to decide whether it's willing to concede that it no longer has absolute hegemony in these regions, or whether it's not going to allow that process to continue, that process of its own weakening hegemony to continue, and it's going to reassert absolute hegemony. And that's the decision that the United States has to make here in Ukraine and in Eastern Europe and in its relations with Russia. And the political dynamic behind that in the United States, I'm afraid, is very bad.
And Tim, what kind of prospect would you see regarding these negotiations, given the divisions inside NATO, and the U.S. also has its issues with it? So would they come to an agreement? Because they are talking about probability of reaching an understanding.
Well, the probability of that really, again, depends on how, like I just said, Washington sees itself. If Washington sees itself, again, as being the monopolar world, the center of everything, then essentially this is all just basically a big dog and pony show. And they're going to, as they have sort of traditionally, generally it's sanctions really put pressure on Russia and then offer Russia some sort of trinkets to maybe get out of this bad situation. Mm-hmm. Essentially, take six steps from the Russians and offer them one or two back. That's the usual MO over the last 30 years. If Washington does see itself as part of a multipolar world, the deal that the Russians have offered of basically giving them more or less the territory of the Soviet Union back is actually a pretty good deal, because if you look on a map, that gives then NATO or Washington pretty much the entirety of Europe. And if Washington also were to be smart about this, it would be a good time to negotiate where Russia's foreign influence can reach at its maximum. Russia does not have that many foreign bases or foreign influence, and they could really lock the Russians into a deal that keeps Russia mostly trapped deep within the Eurasian landmass, and with, I believe there's a base in Vietnam, forgive me, my memory doesn't serve very well sometimes. There's, of course, bases now in Syria and maybe one in Africa, and just keep it at that. And that would really keep the Russians locked into a position. However, the Russians would jump at that type of deal and would be thrilled by it. I think it would make both sides happy. But again, that's only if Washington sees itself as having to deal with having the Russians and the Chinese as political actors for the foreseeable future, and just accept that we've entered a multipolar world, which there's no guarantee of that.
Okay, and one last question for Jim, and that's what you see on the horizon as regards security in Europe and beyond, given the Ukraine issue.
It's very difficult. You know, it's to Russians today, I believe, start to cut gas supplies to Europe. You know, they hope it's the Europeans really who are in the at the center of this and are going to kill themselves with this in every way. Russia has tremendous economic power over Europe, and certainly in any military conflict, Europe's going to be the first to go. Russians are going to go after those missile emplacements in Europe, and so I don't, you know, I'm not sanguine about this. I think that Ukraine, again, there's these other political actors in Ukraine who can push this issue in a way that traps everybody in a situation that's very bad. So I don't see the political dynamic or the political will in the United States to actually sit down and treat Russia as a peer and as some, you know, to essentially what was wrong with the INF treaty, with the internet, with the anti-ABM treaty? These were good things. What really Russia is asking for, let's effectively reconstitute those things in some way or another. The United States pulled out of them because they thought they could get a unilateral advantage, and I don't think they've given up on that.
Okay, and then we'll come to the end of this show. Thanking my guests, independent analysts Tim Kirby in Moscow, journalist and political commentator Jim Kavanaugh in New York. And I've been your host, Behruz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle.